Welcome to Sparks of History, where Jewish history and world history meet. We are extremely pleased to have with us today Professor Ephraim Carnefogel. Dr. Carnefogel received his BA from Yeshiva College and an MA and PhD from the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University. Professor Carnefogel also received rabbinical ordination from Reis, the Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary. Professor Carnefogel is the E. Billy Ivry University Professor of Jewish History, Literature, and Law at Bernard Revel, and also at Stern College for Women. Dr. Carnefogel is considered to be one of the foremost scholars of medieval Jewish history and rabbinic literature. Professor Carnefogel has written and edited numerous books, including, but not limited to, Jewish Education and Society in the High Middle Ages, The Intellectual History and Rabbinic Culture of Medieval Ashkenaz, Brothers from Afar, Rabbinic Approaches to Apostasy and Reversion in Medieval Europe, Between Rashi and Maimonides, Studies in Medieval Jewish Thought, Literature, and Exegesis, and Scholarly Man of Faith, Studies in the Thought and Writing of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik of Blessed Memory. And today we will be discussing the Talmudic commentaries, the Tosafot. And just to get started, sometimes you're at the table and people aren't that familiar with the Talmud, and you say, "Oh, I learned the Tosafot today," and they say, "Who is that?" As it's a commentary, but we know that it's many people. Generally speaking, who are the Tosafot, and why are they called by that name?
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you very much for having me, and I appreciate your precise introduction. Very good. In a word, as you suggested, we are not dealing with, as we do when we deal with Rashi, a single author, more or less, or as we deal with Maimonides, or as we deal with Nachmanides, or whoever it may be. We are dealing with a conglomeration, a conglomerate. The conglomerate can be defined by time. It can be defined by location. The earliest Tosafists are really in the mid-12th century. A name like Rabbeinu Tam, Yaakov Tam, a famous name, is one of the earliest. Not the earliest, I don't think, but one of the earliest. And it runs through the end of the 13th century, both in northern France, in different places. There are different centers, and that shifts, and in different places in Germany, the Rhineland, and later more to the east in Germany as well. And so to be a Tosafist, you don't have to write Tosafot per se, but you have to be involved somehow in the study halls that produce those Tosafot. That's sort of how we define it. Again, there are readers or listeners who might know more or less. You might know that the Tosafot on the printed Talmud are fundamentally from northern France. Those are the ones that made it in, and we could talk later about some of that. But there were Tosafot written in Germany, and there were other works written in Germany that are Tosafot-like in terms of both method and perspective. You're not dealing with hundreds of people. You're dealing with tens of people. It's a little bit of a, for the Americanized listeners, a Wizard of Oz phenomenon. It's a relatively small number of people producing an awful lot of literature with an awful lot of different perspectives. But again, there are circles, there are Batei Midrash and centers that can be identified. We know, I think, most of them, if not all of them by now. We are learning more about what each one did. And Tosafot means addenda. What are they addendering to? They're addending, not a verb, to the Talmud itself. In other words, they're expanding and not free-forming, but they're applying the Talmud. But they're also studying very carefully Rashi's words, their ancestor. He's not the father of all of them, but their ancestor and sort of founder of this Ashkenazi group. And therefore, they are doing the same kinds of things to Rashi himself. Again, short summary, and I'll let you talk some more. First of all, close reading. Why does the Gemara pick this word and not that word? And people think of Tosafot, oh, dialectic. We compare, we contrast. Before you dialectize, also not a verb, you have to read. close reading. Why this word? Why not that word? They do the same thing with the Gemara. They do the same thing with Rashi. You know, I like to joke, they check the Gemara and Rashi's tzitzis first, right? They want to make sure the words are correct. Why is that word being used? That word suggests something subordinate. That word suggests something more critical. And then they, after that close reading, they will correlate and collate. How does this compare to any other Talmudic literature? And in many cases, even extra Talmudic literature, rabbinic literature. And if we find seeming contradictions, how do we resolve those? And how do we apply the distinctions that we derive from those resolutions? They'll do that to Tosfot. They'll do that to Rashi. They'll basically do that to anything that moves. But the things that move for them are these main bodies. So how's that for a long answer to a short question?
Yeah, that's a great answer to a Tosfot question, to a basic question. Already alluded to, Professor Carnapogal, what are the major stages in the development of the Tosafot commentaries?
Okay, so let's take our chronological scope. You know, mid-12th century, again, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, we have actually dates of years of birth and of death. Rashi is 1040 to 1105. His grandson, Rabbeinu Tam, again, is a good starting point for now. There are others, but that's a good starting point for now. His dates are 1100 to 1171. So approximately 1147 and a quarter is the beginning. And again, we run until the very end of the 13th century, Mayer of Rottenburg, who's the last of the German Tosafists, though he studied in France, we'll talk about that too. He dies in jail in a very difficult circumstance in 1293. Rabbeinu Peretz of Corbeil, sort of the last of the French Mohegan Tosafists, dies in 1297. So between those years, you're talking about approximately 150 years. The first period in what some like to call the creative period, which is fair because it's extremely creative, is the period of, in northern France, Rabbeinu Tam, his main student and nephew, Rashi's great-grandson, if you're keeping score, Ri of Dompierre, Yitzchak ben Shmuel of Dompierre, Ri HaZaken as he's called, who dies around 1190, and Ri's main student, Reb Shimshon ben Avram Mishantz, the Rash Mishantz, who really is responsible in many ways for systemic and systematic formulations. Not that Rabbeinu Tam doesn't write any Tosfot, not that Ri doesn't write any Tosfot, all the scholars argue who was the writer, who was the speaker, who was the better speech maker. They have all kinds of interesting, sort of modern ideas, who's the talker, who's the writer, and so on. But Rash Mishantz is the one who kind of brings it together. I think, especially for this august audience, Rash Mishantz makes Aliyah in 1210, dies in Israel in 1214, according to tradition, buried somewhere near Har HaCarmel. But in any case, so that first 50, 60 years, that's sort of the first drop in northern France. And that's a very creative drop because we've got this new dialectic method. It's not brand new, but this newly refurbished or newly souped up dialectic as taught by Rabbeinu Tam, as continued by Ri, as formulated, I mean, they're all teachers and all, but as formulated by Rash Mishantz. On the German side during that period, again, different works and different kind of style, but putable in the same clause. We have, again, just to keep it in the family, somebody like Ra'avad, Rabbi Eliezer ben Nosson of Mainz, who was born before the First Crusade in 1096, about 6 years old when it happened. He then remains in Rhineland, Germany, which, again, not completely incomparable. Well, we don't like to compare any of these things. Same way we talk about how quickly, so to speak, relatively speaking, and how fabulously, relatively speaking, you know, knowing that we lost a lot, how quickly Torah study recovered after the Shoah in Israel, in the United States, and so on. This is, you know, Erev Rosh Hashanah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu works that way, and things recover. So Eliezer of Mainz, and his grandson, Ravia, Eliezer ben Yoel Halevi, grandson through the son-in-law, Rabbi Yoel Halevi, they are in the same period in Germany, the same, you know, same approximate period. Ravan is a contemporary of Rabbeinu Tam. Ravia is a drop younger than Rash Mishantz. They produce big works of halacha and Tosfot. In other words, it's Tosafist halachic study based on the Talmud, similar methods to what's found in France. I like to say, and this is really based on something that Professor Tashma Alav HaShalom said, I say it my way with American slang, the French Tosfot are a bit friskier, but the method is very similar. And so even though the style is different. And the final point here, by the way, is in addition to the close reading and the dialectic and all this comparison, all this really systematic kind of comparison, leave no stone unturned, there is also application for halakha. And that's, again, what unites. In other words, this is not Rashi on Shas, very rarely paskins the halakha based on sugya A or B. Not his job. He's interpreting. Parshan data. Tosfot, not in every case, but in many, many cases, says, and therefore, because of our analysis, we decided the halacha is this way, that way, in this sugya, in the comparative sugya, as Rav Soloveitchik said, the Tosfot created the kosher kitchen because they brought all the sugyot in Avodah Zarah and in Chulin that deal with kashrus, and they did the dialectical scan and comparison, and so the results of what you can do and what you can't do come down very nicely if you look at Tosfot. So these are really very, to say they're multifaceted works is to understate it.
So we have the French, we have the German. Mm-hmm. What do we have beyond the French and the German? And are these works the product of an organized yeshiva network? Is that where it's coming out of?
Okay, good question. So first of all, just to say, and to sort of finish up the other question, things don't end with this creativity. In other words, and you know, even though some of my colleagues like to think that the 13th century sort of they rested on their laurels, I don't think that's quite true either. There's activity going on. In other words, students beget students. So Ri has students, Rosh Mishans has students. Students continue, and the students continue to work on what they receive from their predecessors. And not in all cases, but in many cases, they add. We then come to later collection of this material. So let me talk about that a little bit. Some of this is very understandable. For example, if you look at Northern France in the 13th century, one of the things that you'll find that you don't find so much in the 12th century are halachic works. Something called Sefer HaTruma, by a student of the Ri, Baruch ben Yitzchak, who also made Aliyah. He probably died en route, unfortunately, in that same 1210 period. That's basically the Ri as a halachic work. He takes his teacher's comments, halachizes it, collation, which I don't like to quote the historian Toynbee for a lot of reasons, but Toynbee said, it's a Beferish of Toynbee, a period, Professor Tversky mentions this, Halav HaShalom, in his Rivet book, a period of creativity is almost inevitably followed by a period of collection. So some of it is just organizing, you know, in different ways, what we did with the prior period. However, there is more than just organization in the 13th century. Again, it depends where. Now, we are dealing with relatively small Batei Midrash. For example, there's a famous, not a story, it's an account of the Ri's Beit Midrash, which, to give it proper context and proper sense, appears in a Spanish work of the mid-14th century, something called Tzedal HaDerech, although the author says his father is from northern France, so there is some connection. So about 200 years, 150 years after all this was happening, comes this account that in Ri's Beit Midrash, there were 60 students, 6-0. And 60 is the rough number of all the tractates in the Talmud, Mishnayot and Gemara, those of whom we don't have Gemara, right? And each student had memorized, literally memorized cover to cover, top to bottom, one tractate. And so I'm going to paraphrase here. When Ri would say, we're learning today Masechet Megillah, I don't know, Masechet Rosh Hashanah, and we have the following text that says X, Y, Z, what do you say, Mr. Brachot? What do you say, Mr. Bav Mitzia? What do you say, Mr. Zvachim? And that's how they managed to cover all that ground. They had these, you know, again, medieval memory is a whole interesting question. Human beings are the same, but today we have computers and things, so our memories get shot. They really remembered, and the ones who were best at that really remembered, and that's how they covered things. Now, we don't know 60 students of Ri in his entire lifetime. So it's pretty clear that that number in this story, not, you know, a complete fable, it's, you know, hyperbole, it's a little bit exaggerated. If Ri had 20 students with him at one time, that's probably pretty good because the size of these yeshivot were small. They were located primarily in the teachers' houses and in the neighborhood. And the other thing is, you couldn't sit in these Batei Midrash unless you could, as we say in French, hold cup, unless you could produce with this level of material. You had to know all of Shaito. You had to know everything. This was not for everyone. There's no public school system in the Middle Ages in this part of, you know, Jewish Europe, and so on and so forth. So they didn't have, you know, track one, track two, track three. It was a teacher and a relatively small number of students, right? And, you know, again, 15, 20, well, I get to 25, but I think the lower numbers are more likely. Now, the story of the 60 students at one time in front of Re, some have suggested, was exaggerated a drop to try to explain how did they cover so much stuff. And the answer is generation one uncovered what it uncovered, gave it to generation two. Now generation two doesn't have double the material. They have four times the material. It's geometric. And that's how the Tosafists seem to cover everything in such thorough fashion. Well, I should add, unlike Rashi, who doesn't comment on every word in the Gemara, but who goes line by line, the Tosafists are they write glosses, they pick and choose. They don't cover every single sugya fully, right? It's not chidushim where they go line by line, I say this, I say that. They pick their spots. They pick a lot of spots. They're not finicky. But so that's how the Tosafists get produced, this Beit Midrash sort of turbo. And again, this is like a gathering snowball. By the time you get to post Rashi Mishantz and his colleague, somebody like Yudas Sirleon of Paris, who dies in Paris in 1224, you've already got lots of texts, lots and lots of texts, and not completely dissimilar to the Talmud itself, right? Earlier and middle Amoraim had their own Talmud copies before Ravina and Rav Ashi finally redacted it. That happens here too. And so as the 13th century progresses, even though there still is creativity, one of the things that happens is that you start to get collections of Tosfot, which really try to bring large bodies together and sometimes bring different Batei Midrash together, bring layers. And so you get a layered effect. All right. So I started by saying halachic works in France. Baruch ben Yitzchak Sefer HaTruma is not so well known, even though it had a nice dissertation written about it by a very nice Israeli fellow, Yoshua Friedman. Anyway, it's getting more known. Sefer Mitzvot Gadol by Moshe of Kutzi, that we know. He's a Frenchman through and through. Now, he also went to Spain, and he's got interest in the Rambam, so he's a little bit unusual, but not too. Sefer Orzarua. In other words, so you start to get halachic collections to try to pick up the gap, and you get Tosfot collections to pick up the gap. We can talk about sort of the three or four main ones, but here's the interesting thing. Rashi Mishantz, his Tosfot, at the bottom, under the 20 mattresses of all the Tosfot, the PEA at the bottom is Tosfot Rashi Mishantz. He's the nugget. Anything you get from him is wonderful, and things are then built up on that. And sometimes on some Masechtot, we're lucky we have sort of the original Tosfot Rashi Mishantz that are longer, interesting, longer than the printed Tosfot. Notice the original version was longer, fuller, and they got, I use the analogy of pressed wood. You have to put the generations together and it presses down. It's not crummy, you don't lose things, but you have to elide and you have to, which is why people who study Tosfot sometimes say, what's exactly the connection between line two and line three here? What happened here? And the answer can be, even though it's not always possible to forensically go line by line and say, oh, this is from there, this is from there. You're putting together different Batei Midrash, you know, a little bit like the Gemara. One from, you know, 1189, one from 1221, one from, and so on. And some Masechta, we can identify whole strata, you know, stratum one, stratum two, and so on and so forth.
Okay. Going back to the beginning a little bit, if there are scores of Tosafot, how many are Rashi's descendants? And it seems, Professor, from what you're saying is that even if there wasn't Rashi, there would have been Tosafot. We kind of think Tosafot have to go with Rashi, but it sounds that it didn't have to go with Rashi.
Well, perhaps, you know, this is Hanistarot Lashem Elokeinu, perhaps, except the Wissenschaft scholars, you know, Jewish scholars in the 19th century, very interesting critical study and so on, had a great description of Rashi. They call Rashi Maslul HaTalmud, a path through the Gemara. Had Rashi not made the path, somebody else might have, you know, we could alternate history. Who would it have been? Shoulda, coulda, woulda, mighta. And so as long as you have a path through, once you can get through the bush and get through the brush and clear, solu derech, you can then have this, running with the ball. But the fact is that Rashi was not just, good at it. He was the greatest at it. There were other Perushim, so-called students of Rabbeinu Gershom and so on, that were not nearly as effective as Rashi. They were great, but they weren't as effective as Rashi. With Rashi, for his immediate descendants like Rabbeinu Tam and Ri, I don't say it's a chip shot at all. They had to bring this new method. They had to, again, question how new the method is, where they got it from. There might have been pieces earlier, some interesting questions about possible Christian influence. I don't mean religious influence, but intellectual influence and so on. Once they got the method, Rashi opened the book. So I can't tell you that without Rashi, there wouldn't have been Tosfot, but it probably would have taken a lot longer, and it might not have been as finely done as it was done, because, jumping off of Rashi, which is why the Tosfot check Rashi's tzitzis too, because he becomes almost part of the Talmud. So that partnership is what gives them the ignition. Yes. As far as who's related, smaller Jewish communities, everybody's related. It's like, there are people like that related to everybody. However, and there are, Yudas Irleon, who I mentioned, dies in 1224, is a descent, is a familial relation of Rashi. Plenty who are, plenty who aren't, But again, it's the old story. Balatosot one, his sister marries his buddy, his chavruta, So there's a certain amount of familial, there's a certain amount of intellectual aristocracy, but not in a stark way. There were plenty of Balatosot who aren't related to anybody except the people they're related to, So, but it certainly has a lot to do with Rashi. Interesting, by the way, as far as I'm concerned, this is Machloket HaChokrim, the first Tosafist, the George Washington, so to speak, the David Ben Gurion, the first one of the Tosafists was actually a German named Yitzchak Ben Asher Halevi, Yitzchak Halevi of Spira, who died in 1133. He's kind of a transitional figure, and we don't have a lot from him. So some scholars have taken the position he wasn't the Rabbeinu Tam. And the answer is, how do you know? We've only got a tenth of the material. And that from that tenth, he looks like a Rabbeinu Tam. To make it even stronger, Rabbeinu Tam acquired a cohort, almost a clique of German students who had studied with Rav Shapira, who died fairly suddenly, 1133. There's an interesting story about that, has to do with the fact that he was supposed to not eat on Yom Kippur, and he did, and therefore, and so on. It's a later source. But they all hightailed it. As soon as he was nifter, they ran right to Rabbeinu Tam. Matzah min esmino, right? One, if you're with Rav Shapira, the only person you go to after that is Rabbeinu Tam. If you're learning with, I don't know who, you have to go from the Rav, you have to go to this one, whoever it may be. So again, also he's a connected person, so to speak, and he's learning and he's inspired. He perhaps was in Worms before the First Crusade. So everybody's got some level of connection, but it's not a kind of an aristocracy. If you're not in the club, if you're not in the right, the right last name, you can't get in. It's not that kind of thing at all.
Okay. And no Tosafot outside of Europe, none from the Islamic countries, Bavel, North Africa.
Listen, lo karim lezet Tosafot. In other words, the name Tosafot is a fundamental. I mean, the word Tosafet, that's when you go to a restaurant in Israel, they tell you what do you want for the Tosafet, it can be, right? So you spend a lot of time in, not in restaurant, but in Israel. not a big restaurant man. But, It's the nomenclature. There are Tosfot. We do have a very interesting Italian Baal HaTosfot named Rabbi Yeshaya de Trani, who dies around 1230 CE and probably studied in the Rhineland before that, where he learned some of Rabbeinu Tam's Torah from Rabbeinu Tam's students who went back to the Rhineland. He calls Rashi, interestingly, Hamoreh, the Rebbe, because he's from Italy. So if you're from northern France, right, you can talk about the Kuntrus. They had notebooks. They had, texts of Rashi that, again, his family, his closest students had these texts. They'll talk about sometimes French Tosafot. We'll talk about Rabbeinu Shlomo. They don't talk about Rashi too much. German, there are very few German Tosafot printed in the Shas. One of the best examples in our printed Shas is Masachet Sota, where they keep quoting Perush Rashi. Now, not that other Tosafot never do that, but again, if you think about it, it's either the Kuntrus or who's Rashi? I mean, that name, that acronym is a little bit late in coming. The Germans are not as close to Rashi. They're very close in learning, but they're not they're not coming from the same Ursprung. So they talk about Pirush Rashi. The Ried talks about the Moreh in his Pirush on Chumash too, the Rebbe. And he's a big Rashi fan, even though part of his calling card is he agrees with no one. If it doesn't work well in the Gemara, he'll disagree with anybody. He disagrees with Rashi, but he's still in the Rebbe. So we have Italian Tosfot. There might be others. Provence and Spain consume Tosfot. In other words, let me explain what I mean by that. Ramban, anybody who knows Chedusha Ramban knows that Ramban quotes Chachmei Tzarfat every four long, every four pieces, every two pieces, every one piece. As much as Ramban is Sfaradi Tahor, and he's working with the Rambam, and he's working with the Gaonim, in his Chiddush Manshas, he quotes a considerable amount, let's put it mildly, of Tosfot. Doesn't always agree with them in Halach, in fact, often disagrees, but their analysis is at the root of also his conceptual system, which is beyond Tosfot in terms of the conceptualization. That's a whole different discussion. Quotes a ton of Tosfot, a ton. And from there to his student, the Rashba, and from there to his student, who quotes even more because he's got new stuff coming in, the Ritva, and so on. So these Chachmei Sfarad, the Chidushei, I'm going to say this very carefully, nobody should get upset. Chidushei Ramban, Rashba, Ritva would be half of what they are without Tosfot. And that's that amount. But they're not writing Tosfot. They may disagree with Tosfot. They may analyze. Avaz Chidushim is a little Tosfot. That's how it sort of develops. And the prior stage was the northern French material came down to southern France. That's how the Ramban got it, because he had Rebbeim who either went to northern France to learn from Provence and so on. So the stuff moves very quickly southbound. The Baal HaMor and the Ravid both love Rabbeinu Tam. And at one point, the Ravid says to Baal HaMor, you are Zanav La Tzorfativ, you're too French, you're too northern French, right? You're hanging around with Rabbeinu Tam too much. That should be the worst problem. So this stuff is a revolution, and it then gets carried, cultural transference, agents of culture, by individuals, by books, and so on. But the Tosfot locus is again, I don't know if anybody, there were Spanish shasin that were either copied or printed with Ramban instead of Tosfot, but they didn't call it Tosfot, they called it Ramban. There are a couple of those.
Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, and might have alluded to this already, describes the focus of the Tosafos dialectics as collation, contradiction, and distinction. What does that mean?
Yeah, just a nice way to say it, but I think it's very basic as follows. Again, I would say first step with all studying with Professor Soloveitchik as well when I was a kid. Anyway, And I have my doctorate is from his Dr. Vater, Professor Yaakov Katz in New York. I'm a Ketzela from 100 years ago, the great Professor Katz. Uh-huh. Anyway, Zchutia Gdola. The first thing again is close reading. Before you start, throwing the thumbs, close reading. The collation, again, collatio, by the way, some of this is based on Christian, medieval Christian learning, which is fine here, right? Lectio to read, collatio to bring together. Right? Collation. Now, collatio doesn't mean to find all the contradictions. It means to just get everything on the table that needs to be on the table. You then go to, well, what does that collation reveal? Is everybody voting the same way? Or do we have Sugya A voting, Republican and Sugya B voting Democrat, Lahavdil, right? If there are contradictions, and there are, the assumption of the Tosfot is that Ravina Ravashi produced a unified Shas, Mitzvah Liyashev, right? In other words, unless there's an impossibility, and sometimes Tosfot says, Midrashim Chalukim, Sugyot Chalukot, never the twain will meet. But 99% of the time, they come out with what he's calling distinction. In other words, dialectic as a concept presumes that the contradictions are resolvable, right? You have two, if not opposite, conflicting propositions. You create a circle, not in a silly way, but you create a structure into which both propositions fit. This one is covering case A or concept A. This one is covering variation B. So the fact that one sugya seems to say chayav, one sugya seems to say patur, and it's all talking about the same shomrim, no, but it depends. How was the shmirah established? How was the arrangement, canceled and so on? So that's what Tosfot does. So read it, bring it together. By the way, in the Christian terms, lectio, collatio, and then you get to disputatio. That sounds like the what's happening in Israel. Anyway, never mind that. We're having a you know, a little discussion there. So that's what they're doing.
A small dispute.
A little fire. Right. The answer is that Tosfot usually can figure it out. I don't know. We're a little not so well today. But again, and they will not just figure it out in gross terms. They will work out all of the moving pieces, right? There are four sugyas. So the one that does it this way will say, here's how we do one, here's what. In other words, it's a very organized resolution. That's the whole point. And that's what he means to say, I think, by distinctions. Not distinctions that we're left with problems. How do we fit all the moving parts into one lovely solution? Marshal, Reb Shlomo Luria, who lived in the 16th century, one of our early Achronim, who was a big connoisseur of Tosfot, not that he needs my approval, he knew about different versions and different tractates. He's got a lot to say about that. In the introduction to Yom Shel Shlomo, his two favorite Sfarim are the Rambam, because he gets everything together seamlessly. And on the other hand, in almost the opposite direction, right, are the Tosfot, Sha'asu et ha-Talmud le-Kadur Echad. The Rambam gets everything together, but the Rambam will mow down sugyas. If there are two sugyas, one says Chayiv, one says Potter, the Rambam will say, we paskin like the Chayiv sugya. How do I know? Yerushalmi Tosefta, I know. He's got, you know, he basically says, let that one go, keep this one, which was the Gelnik method as well. Tosfot says Maharshal makes the Talmud ki kadur echad, a spheroid. Hafhu v'gilgaluhu. You know, it's like a matzo ball. It goes around and around and around. And there are no sharp corners. Everything comes together, not in their work. They can say different things, but in the Talmud. Right? So those are your two options. You can either say Talmud has two possibilities. I know to pick sugya one. I know this is the sugya l'halacha. One, and there are other ways to do it. That's the Rambam's way to do it. I'm saying this very broadly. Gaonic way to do it. Tosfot says, make it all a very smooth, it all, it's one big happy Talmud here. So that's how they, that, and that's what Fred Soloveitchik is ultimately says, distinctions. Yes, there are distinctions, but here's how we handle them. In other words, here's how all the distinctions are smooth. Now, once in a while, again, Tosfot says, this doesn't fit. Rarely. Once in a while, Tosfot says, very rarely, we don't get this Gemara. There's something wrong here. Very rarely. Oh, Visham. Professor Orbach has these things in his magisterial work, Baliat Tosfot. But that's so uncommon, you'll almost never find it. Generally speaking, they manage to get us through in this way.
What are the Tosfot Tuch? And what was Eliezer Tuch's role in editing them?
Okay. So this brings us to these Tosfot collections, right? Again, by the time you get to the mid-13th century, you've got layers and layers and layers of Tosfot on different tractates. Some of them do go with each other. Some of them are separate. And so you get a series of figures in the, again, Rosh Mishans has edited the earlier material, and Ruta Sirleon has edited, the students of Re have edited some of the early, edited, redacted, put together the early material. But by the time you get to the mid to late 13th century, the last part of this period, you really need massive, you know, organizing. And there are several figures who do this. Perhaps the most famous in some respects is Rabbi Lezmi Tuch. Interesting, machloket between Professor Urbach, Alav HaShalom, and others is Tuch. It's a funny name. Spelled usually with a tet, except in those medieval sources that's spelled with a taf, right? Is it Turchheim in Germany, a German town? We're not sure exactly, but we think we know approximately where it is. Or is it Tuchs, some kind of French settlement? The reason that question comes up is because Rabbi Eliezer Mituch worked mostly with Tosfot Rabbeinu Tam, Ri, Rosh Mishans. It's organizing and cutting down, fitting in the earlier material with a little bit of later material. The other reason we like Tosfot Tuch is because, as fate would have it, his Tosfot were the ones that lead the league, more or less, in terms of what appears in our printed Talmud. In other words, his editing job or his redacting job was good enough, so good that, you know, again, that begs the question, how do we know what Tosfot we have and why? And the why sometimes is because that's the manuscript that was available. Very hard to know in exact science. But as it turns out, his fingerprints are all over our printed Tosfot. Again, he mostly worked. He didn't work with 13th century material. He had his own notes that were put into what he called Gilio note. He made footnotes for his own stuff. I had a doctoral student, actually, he's a Skan Menahelet Shalavim, Arya Leibowitz, did a wonderful dissertation on Lez Mituch, where he separated, he showed what he put in the Tosfot, what he put in the Kilyarno. Very nice job. But he basically brings all that earlier material together and shortens and edits, which is good and bad. The good news is it fits on the page, or the page fits on it. The not as good news is you have to make choices. You have to make snips. You have to make edits. And even if you're a brilliant editor, you know, we'd be better off if we had every word of the earlier material. We don't always have that. And that's why sometimes it looks like a little choppy. So he's perhaps the most popular or the most productive editor of this type. But there are others. Rav Asher ben Yechiel, the Rosh, who people might know his biography a little bit. He's a student of Maharam, again, late 13th century Germany, not a place you want to be. The Rosh, while his Rebbe's body is still in jail in 1303, 4, leaves Germany, goes through France, northern, southern, down, ultimately down to Spain. The Rashba directs him to Toledo, where he settles. And already in Germany, he produced what we call Tosfot HaRosh. Tosfot HaRosh are his take on Tosfot Shans, again with addenda from his Rebbe, from the Rambam. Printed Tosfot hardly ever quote the Rambam. He quotes the Rambam, he quotes the Ravid, he went through southern France and so on and so forth. Interestingly, not one of the printed Tosfot that we have to any Masechta are Tosfot HaRosh. We have 20 Masechtas of it. He did a great job. 20 is, you know, two-thirds of the extant Talmudic Masechtot. But those did not make it into the printed edition. Again, not everybody had them through the centuries. By now, we've had most of them published from manuscript. They're very helpful. The reason they're very helpful is he basically starts the Tosfot Shans. Those are the clearest. And he doesn't do the same kind of heavy editing as Lez Mituch. So Yeshiva Bachrim and Benot Yeshiva will all tell you, you're having trouble with a Tosfot, get the Tosfot HaRosh. Because it's a little bit earlier stuff, a little bigger, a little clearer, less cutting. But again, on the other hand, printed Tosfot don't include Tosfot HaRosh. They do include Tosfotuch. There are others.
Tosfotuch, in addition to editing, we have his original commentary as well.
Well, we have his notes, if you will. We have his further chidushim. He studied with people in both northern France and Germany in the mid-13th century. We have some of that. But that he segregates so as not to confuse things, which is helpful. Po Visham, those things appear in the printed Tosfot, but usually not. Po Visham, you'll see, you know, things from under the line, so to speak. I want to mention one more name. My candidate for French editor of the whatever is Rabbeinu Peretz of Corbeil. Again, late 13th century, little older than the Rosh, around the time of Lez Mituch, who's a student of a very interesting Beit Midrash at Evreux. Evreux in Normandy actually is responsible for our Tosfot to Kiddushin. Those who learn Kiddushin say, wait, they quote the Ram all the time. The Ram isn't the Rambam. The Ram isn't the Maharami Rittenberg. It's Reb Moshe of Evreux. It's this particular Tosfist who studied with Yehuda Sirleon. They're very interesting Tosfot, these Tosfot. Rabbeinu Peretz was their student, as was the Rabbi Yitzchak of Corbeil, the author of the Sefer Mitzvot Katan, on which Rabbeinu Peretz also commented. Anyway, Rabbeinu Peretz, between Tosfot Evreux and Tosfot Rabbeinu Peretz, almost as many, I think, of our printed Tosfot that are Tuch are Evreux Peretz. So they need a new look. I mean, they've had a look, but I'm going to give them one. They need a new look because, again, they are Rabbeinu Peretz, I would say, he was also a colleague of Maharam. He considered Maharam his teacher, even though he's in France, he's in Germany, but they met, they communicated. Rabbeinu Peretz and Evreux are very creative. There's new stuff there. They're not changing the way Tosfot does business. They're doing business like the older Tosfot, but they've got a lot of new material. So you've got these three or four collections. Again, Tuch, Rosh, Peretz, and there were some others. But
and the Ri
again wrote some of his own, or his students. Rashmi Shantz is his writer. He's his body man. He's his Boswell. You know, he's writing up the stuff. So the Ri was Zocha to this great Talmud who, whatever he didn't write, he wrote. By the way, big question: Tosfot Ri, were they written by Ri Were they written up by the Rosh Mishanth? Did the Ri go over them? Did the Ri not go over them? You know, like Rabban Lichtenstein Zatzal, Mugal, they are a Shiva, lo Mugal, right? You know, they put out all the notes. You know, he did look at it. He didn't look. Did it? And the answer to that question is yes. We don't know. In other words, any of those possibilities are possible. So Ri is obviously the central figure. He and Rabbeinu Tam get the most hits. Right, on every page of Tosfot, if you don't see a Ri or Rabbeinu Tam, you may send it back to the printer. You know, something's wrong. But who wrote those down? So the buck stopped with Rosh Mishanth, but between all of them, a lot of his Torah is there. Interesting, by the way, in the case of Ri, two of my colleagues, one at Bar Ilan and one at Ben Gurion, put out not so long ago, Tshuvot HaRi. The Ri also wrote a lot of Psakim U'Tshuvot. They don't appear in Tosfot. Sometimes they're alluded to. So something, if you look at the manuscripts, there's always something extra we can find. That's the other thing about this. Whenever you think Mitzinu, Mitzinu, lo Mitzinu, there's more. Again, the fact is that by now, because Tosfot is so popular, whether it's, you know, scholarly groups or Lumdisha groups or whoever, most of the manuscripts of Tosfot, X, Y, and Z have been published, but there are all these ancillary pieces that if you want to study the Balei HaTosfot, I once said to one of my seminars in Tosfot, you're probably going to notice that most of the texts in the packet are not Tosfot on Shas, they are Sifrei Halacha, they're Chidushim, they're this, because again, a lot of it ends up falling into these other literary vehicles, but it's still Tosfot material. It's material of Balei HaTosfot, Asur Lahaniach. You've got to put it together.
So when is the first Talmud printed? Who makes the decision what to put in? Who accepts that? And does that change as new editions are printed?
So this is a complicated story that I know a little bit less about. My life is manuscripts. I just said goodbye to the old Sifrei HaLumit 2 weeks ago, and I'm going to be again in November at the new Sifrei HaLumit, because without those manuscripts, I can't work. And I want to say about the manuscripts, before we talk about printed, one of the interesting things about the manuscripts, we don't have that many early Tosfot manuscripts. In other words, and on some Masechtas, how many manuscripts of Tosfot do we have? One. There are even a couple for which we have none. But they were so popular they survived. So even if you know, and if you look through, there's a very wonderful list. Tashba had a Sefer Zikaron where the Yamin Richler, who worked many years at the Machalot of Tzlumi Kitveyad, put out an article on Tosfot in Kitveyad. You look, a lot of the Tosfot that we have, the earliest manuscript is 15th century. That's pretty late. Some are 14th, right? I mean, the earliest medieval Ashkenazic halachic works. It's not like the Geniza. The earliest works are late 12th century, early 13th century. Even Rashi and Chumash, you can hardly get anything before 1180, according to some, and the best one is 1233 and all of that stuff. So a lot of these manuscripts are late, or they're in Tavyad Sfaradi, nothing wrong with that, harder to read, but nothing wrong with that. Again, so it's obviously a derivative. So then the question becomes, well, how do we know these are the Tosfot? And the answer is because everybody had them. And, you know, people like the Trumat HaDeshen or the Marshal later or the Marik will say, oh, yeah, that's the real one. That's our Tosfot. That's ours. They're not working academically. They're just working with, they want to have the right text. So there's not a crisis of faith in terms of the authenticity of the text per se, even though the manuscript bases are not as rich as we might like. And they'd like to have, oh, don't we have six manuscripts on each Masechta we can compare? No. same problem with Rashi on Shas, where there have been some very interesting critical editions of Rashi that they did at Bar Ilan years ago, and I hope they do some more. But then we come to the printing phase, and it gets more complicated. And again, I'm not as into this as I am into the manuscripts, and I'd recommend material, especially by, I'll say something anyway, but Marvin Heller has some really good stuff on the printing of the Talmud. You also have the fellow, Yaakov Meyer, who's working on Talmud manuscripts, but he's working also on the development of the printed Talmud, doing terrific work. The problem is, I mean, I had one teacher who once said, the printed Tosfot are the cheapest manuscripts. I don't think he's exactly right, but he's not far off. In other words, Mashi Gili Adam, they print it. And again, Jewish printers, non-Jewish printers, advisors. So some of it was helter-skelter. Now, so you'll tell me, so maybe our Tosfot are junk, God forbid. Again, the answer is there were enough lomdim who had learned Tosfot even before printing, right? In some copied forms. There are people who, you know, you could still meet a few today, not as many as you used to meet, who can tell you, you know, Rashi and Tosfot, Oisevenig, you know, Baal Peh, up and down the pages, and they would tell you, yes, no, maybe, right? The same way the Bach goes, puts in this word, takes out that word. He's got it all. He's not sitting with 50 manuscripts. He's sitting with his head and things that he knows. So the good news is this: there's nobody who thinks the Tosfot on Masechet X are mezuyafim. There's no such, as far as I know. There's Besamim Rosh, which is a tribute to the Rosh, Tshuvot, which may be mezuyafim, even though Rabbi Kiva quotes from Halacha, but anyway, we won't go into that now. There are famous Yufim. Tosfot is not among them. Having said that, it behooves us, but as I say, I think it's actually been done to a large extent to make sure that everything that we have in manuscript is reviewed. And by the way, to ascertain the proper text of Tosfot, it's not sufficient to look at all the manuscripts of Tosfot or all the printed, early printed editions, and Canubula, all that stuff. You also have to look at other Tosafist works which contain Tosfot. There's one, somebody once asked me something about a Tosfot in Erevin, and I said to them, oh, yeah, you got to look here in the Or Zarua. He's got a better version. I said, the Or Zarua is a Sefer Halacha, Hilchot Erevin, Mashayachu La Tosfot. I said, no. He's got a whole piece of Tosfot Rosh Mishans that he got when he was in Paris. He stuck them into the Sefer Or Zarua. You want to know the best Tosfot text? And sure enough, on that particular passage, very interesting about how many mezuzahs you need, what rooms, and so on. Mem Aleph, Mem Gimel, somewhere. Anyway, I'm forgetting. Much longer version, much more specifics in that Or Zarua. So the good news is we generally have true Tosfot. Again, they're complicated by the fact that Elazar Mituch's, pressed wood sometimes elides some of the connections, but he's really dealing with early material. He's got his Re and his Rosh Mishans and his Rabbeinu Tam. So we don't always have the original version exactly, but there's very little, the famous Tosfot Ketubot on Daf Kuf Yud, where Tosfot says, Reb Chaim says, that Bizman HaZeh no mitzvah la'alot, right? And he goes, Talmid Toeh, Red Lom, yeah? Yeah, fine. I can find just six other texts where he says exactly that in other contexts, say for Mordechai, and there's a whole machloket between French and German scholars, rabbinic scholars of that period, on this very point. So, again, not that we can't argue the merits of the position, but it's Rabbeinu Tam says in one place in Tosfot Avodah Zarah about touching non-Jewish wine and what that does in terms of Jews doing business with it. Oh yeah, the Talmud who wrote that Tosfot, the Talmud who copied it, I'm going to say it my way, wasn't ready for prime time. You know, that line, change that line. Some things that Povisham have to be fixed, but I don't think we have crisis of faith or crisis of halacha or crisis of substance that our Tosfot are somehow mezuyafim or we've got incomplete. Like I say, if you can get earlier Tosfot, they're usually fuller, more informative. No sin in that, right? If you want to learn the Tosfot with the Tosfot Arush and know more and impress your Rebbe, I'm sure he'll be impressed. You know, Hechatayadata, stay door, right? By the way, the Tosfot Arush, it's been noticed by Lamdanim, same as Tosfot that Ramban cites, because he's working off Tosfot Shans. He's a smart man. He used early Tosfot. He knew he had this early material. He was working with the original thing. So I guess what I'm saying is the Tosfot has pretty good checks and balances. Again, it's a dirty word today, but pretty good checks and balances within itself. You know, it's hard to fool the whole complex. An individual might say, Ech ani yodea, but if you survey the literature properly, not hard to pinpoint. So the printing issue is an issue, but I think it's not a fatal one.
Were Tosafot manuscripts found in the Cairo Geniza? Where are these manuscripts? And what are you looking at when you come after the holidays to the university and sit and look at manuscripts? What are you looking at?
Right. So first of all, right. So there are some Tosfot that made it to the Cairo Geniza. There are interesting Perushim on Shas that are Rashi-esque, that they didn't have in Ashkenaz, And someone theorized very nicely, Rashi was so great, these are Rashi-like. You know, if you got Rashi, throw the other ones out. Send them over to the Knesset. It's not that simple, but it's an interesting idea. Look, there were also Tosafists who made Aliyah and who brought material or who traveled. A colleague and I published a text years ago from Yosef Ish Yerushalayim, as he's called in Tosafot, Yosef of Clisson, a young student of Ri, on Tefillin, on whether he paskin like Rashi, Rabbeinu Tam, and so on. And it was identified by a paleographer in Israel as Ktav Yad Ashkenazi, might be an autograph, landed up in the Cairo Geniza because he was in Israel. So these texts can move, that's not surprising. Any library anywhere in the world, primarily Europe, we're not really Europe, Russia, there were no Jewish Kitvei Yad as far as I know in China, I mean not from the medieval period in China or in I'm not Australia, but certainly most of them are European in their origin. Any library could have had pieces of Tosfot. They're also doing a lot with bookbindings now. Right, little, somebody thought that we had found a couple of pages from a Rashi to Maseches Nozir that we don't have Rashi on, stuck into a bookbinding to keep it concave, right? Turned out it was a false alarm, but everybody's all excited about that. So over the years, I mean, this is, I give you a separate talk on the Machon LaTatzlumei Kitvei Yad that Professor Tashma headed for decades and then others headed before him, really a great contribution to Medinat Yisrael, besides everything else. Where they went and they microfilmed anything that they could get their hands on. And then it took people a number of years to go through all the stuff and find out, b'diyuk ma'yesh lanu sham. By now, that fact-finding mission has gone so well that, as I say, whether scholars or lamdanim or chasidim or mitnagdim or you name it, have pretty much put their fingers on almost every piece of Tosfot you could imagine. Now, obviously, I mean, you could publish a fragment of two pages. That would be a little article somewhere. But the big pieces, a lot of them have been published. However, lo mitzino, I don't expect, I mean, I go there always assuming I'm going to be finding the, Taglit Olamisham, but it doesn't always work that way. You can always find, though, pieces. And I have an article, for example, coming out on something called Tosfot Shita. Was Heist Mazet Tosfot Shita? So the Chida, the great bibliographer, died in 1806, who saw every manuscript of, he was a Shliach Eretz Israel to Europe. And while he was busy doing what he had to do in his spare time of none, he looked at every Ktav Yad he could get his eyes on. He also remembered every Ktav Yad he could get his eyes on. And he talks about Tosfot Shita. He says that's a way of saying not Tosfot Shans. He's got, anyway, I have this article coming out, and I think it's just because he couldn't see every manuscript in the world. And my mazel, I found one that he didn't see. Beginner's luck, dumb luck. It refers to a certain group of 13th century Tosafists. There's a new category. Now, we'll see if people buy it. They may disagree. It has to do a lot with the Ma'arik, has to do other things. So we're looking to see how now to flesh out and how to, expand this corpus. When I go, I'm typically going for my own projects, but that's the point. You could be working on any of the books that you just mentioned of mine, that you mentioned a while back already of mine. And in the course of doing those books, I found all these other things. In other words, once you go through Kitvei Yad, the main misima is to read. You can't read randomly, but if you're reading Ashkenazi Kitvei Yad, and, so the first problem is you have to have a pretty good idea of what we have. You have to have a pretty good idea of what we don't have, and you have to have an idea of what you think you have that we don't have. Sometimes it turns out you're 100% right, and you get an extra helping of dessert, and sometimes it turns out you were dead wrong, we know that already, and you get no dessert. But that's the thrill of victory and the not agony of defeat, because there's no defeat here. That's the less of a thrill to know, oh, we have that. But again, the connections are very interesting. So it's basically all, and that's how we were trained. And that's, by the way, what Bechirei Chokrei Eretz Israel did for decades. And it's interesting because the Sifriya Lumit new model has almost everything digitized. And not that they don't want you to come to look at the Kitvei Yad on, but you can do it in your house. Except for the 15% or 10% that are not digitized. And it's always that one that has the best stuff. So this is, it's all about, mazel shall say for Torah. You have to try to figure it out. So for example, I used to go working on some of these topics. the Sefer Mordechai, which is a Likut, a late 13th century collection, French, German, Tosfot, Halacha. It's a grab bag. Found in the printed Shas at the very, very back. I don't know if you've ever seen a Sefer Mordechai. It's a Tunat Rachim Sham, you know, intellectuality. It's just, it's a mess. They've got parentheses, brackets, things you can't read. You go to the Kitvayad, get some good ones, get the 10 best Kitvayad. You're a smart person, you know a lot more. So I used to have to go. If I was working on something that I wanted to look at a Mordechai, I would bring my list of 10 Kitvayad. I'd say, okay, let's check. Now, Machon Yerushalayim has put out an edition of Sefer Mordechai on everything. Now, the problem is they don't go through all 10. They go through about 6. Not bad. So again, you get to, but that's the kind of intensive labor that you know, people say to me all the time, you come to Israel for 4 days and you sit in the library the entire 4 days. What are you doing? I said, I'm, you know, shining my shoes. But it's very labor intensive, but kachidar kashal tarah. If you don't do it that way, it's not going to get done. But I encourage people who are interested, you have to get your feet wet in this kind of business. That's what my doctorantim do. Not all of them, but that's what some of them do, the ones with whom I'm luckiest. Once there's Professor Idel, who did his whole thing based on Kitvayad. So you make all the doctorantim use the Kitvayad. He said, listen, I tell them they should. They're adults. They decide. Those who do, we think, do the best work. But again, it doesn't always work because you can go through 10 Kitvayad and find nothing. But the 11th one, oh, Vudabar. So I will sometimes call my wife after a day in the library and I will say, she will say, how was the day? I will say, one of those. One of those means if you told me to get on the plane, fly to Yerushalayim, spend 1 day in the library, and then turn around and come home, I would do it. So, you know, every trip, there's always 1 day like that, Baruch Hashem. Anyway, but that's something I'm going on.
Just in conclusion, my youngest, my Ben Zakunin, who I told him he must listen to this interview, but I'm going to tell him to listen up to this point because they'll be upset at me for mentioning him at all. So he is a 12th grader and he is, I mean, he's immersed in his Gemara learning, in the sugi. He gets very deep into it. Non-academically, what advice would you give to Tosfot learners, to Talmud learners, how to approach a Tosfot in a non-academic way, obviously?
Right. So I think what I would say, and it's interesting, I was just discussing it with a seminar of Dr. Antum last night. If you spend all your time doing some of the things I'm talking about, you won't learn too much. It'll take too much time. Part of the trick is, you know, which did you do first? How much did you do it? You know, bring it all together. Look, I sat with Rav Soloveitchik for years. Rav Soloveitchik was a Rishonophile of the highest order. Not that he didn't care about the Achronim. He knew all them by heart, too. He knew all the Ksos. He knew all the Shagas. He knew everything. But he focused us on Rishonim. So already at a young age, and all his students were my teachers over the years. So you already have an Itiyah Lezeh. What I would tell yeshiva people who are studying seriously, don't worry about the Kitvayad. Again, do use the quote-unquote scholarly resources that are easily available. For example, a lot of times you're working on a sugi in Tosfos, get the Ritva on that sugi, go into the Moshe Rav Kook footnotes. They'll tell you things you didn't know that you didn't know from Tosfot that will help you learn that Tosfot because the Ritva knows Tosfot great. In other words, use every critical edition that you decide. I don't mean everyone, but you'll learn which are the most helpful. As far as learning itself, though, think about who says it. How do we know he said it? Let's think about layers, right? Think about, is this all? Tosfot is not Miroe Echad, right? If you find a stira in the Rambam, you can immediately make a big shtickel Torah. If you find a stira in Tosfot, the Marash already said, stay calm. Zemachloket, zelo stira, right? There are two different opinions. And there is value in knowing a little bit of the history, not because I'm just a mafunik, I want you to know dates and numbers and names and places, but because then you can make decisions about the learning. I'll give you an interesting example. Tosfot Avodah Zarah has several layers. First layer is actually Ari's son, Rabbi Chanan ben Hari, who was killed by Kiddush Hashem in 1182, in 84. So he produced Tosfot around 1180. That's sort of the first take. We have them. There's a nice edition that was put out in Israel in 2005. It used to be in this Chinese print. Now it's a lovely thing with footnotes. It's good. Someone named Kreuzer. The second layer is there is a Rosh Mishans as well. There is a Rabbi Yehuda Sirleon kind of a layer. There's a Rabbi Shlomi Falez and there's a Rabbeinu Peretz. Sometimes the layers don't cohere. For example, rare, Tosfot Yudalad Amud Bet, actually there's an article coming out of this now, but it's already been telegraphed. Tosfot Yudalad Amud Bet in Avodah Zarah talks about financial benefit can Jews, can they trade, can they use as pawns, church garments, things like that, priestly garments of the church and so on and so forth. The chalice, you know, that kind of thing. Very machmir in Tosfot Yudalad Amud Bet. And they mention some name, Baruch Ben Reb, and there's no father's name there. Probably sends it out. Machmir. And Daf Nun, Tosfot of Azar quotes Rashi, Rashbam, the Re is working it, much more Lakula. Now you'll say, well, if it was edited, redacted, didn't they catch the stira? No. And it reflects two, you can't catch everything. And it reflects two completely different schools in the Balei HaTosfot. There's a school of Chumra, a school of Lakula, and it explains everything, and you can buttress it with Sefer Yireim or Belazmi Metz. You can buttress it with Sefer Atruma Baruch of Yitzchak, who's the missing Baruch Ben Yitzchak there, and the learning goes great. Without that, it's a mess. It's a mess. It's like, what do we do? That's a rare find. On the other hand, Tosfot Daf Chof Zayin talks about a woman being a mohelet, a sugya there. Right, a non-Jew can never be a moel because he doesn't have a bris and he's not required to have a bris. Gemara raised the possibility based on psukim about a woman being a mohelet. Never mind Sipora, but just that, right? Machloket Rishonim, Rambam, Geonim, Paskin, a woman can be a mohelet if no better qualified male is available, and she can fill in. And if she's more qualified, take her, right? You have the woman surgeon, take her. Amongst Rishonim Ashkenaz, Machloket, there are some who are very maker. There were some who say outright that min hadin, a woman can be a mohelet. It's a machloket, Rav Yochanan and Rav there in the sugya, paskin like Rav Yochanan, everything's fine. However, Tosfot, a little tiny Tosfot says, no, we paskin like Rav, and we paskin like, because normally we paskin like Rav Yochanan against Rav. We paskin like Rav because there's a bright at the top of the page that forces the hand of the Gemara. Okay. So there's a wonderful article, I won't say by who, Choker Chashuv, Mamish Great, where he wrote about the fact that in Smag, there seemed to be Tishtushim, where they try to fabester the Smag. First, the Smag said it was mutter for a woman to be a mohelet, and then as the Smag editions progressed, it starts saying the Smag paskins, it's awesome. So never mind that we know now that the Smag wrote multiple versions of, say, from Mitzvot, at least two, maybe three, maybe he changed his mind. Leave that alone. But there's a problem here. In other words, so basically the claim is, at the end of the 13th century, right, Rabbeinu Peretz, Tosfot Rabbeinu Peretz, they decide to be machmir, you know, from Kai, they decide to be machmir again. The problem is what nobody seemed to know, well, people noticed it, but they didn't know what to do with it. Tosfot Rabbi Chanan is machmir, Tosfot Rosh Mishans is machmir, other Tosfot pieces of machmir. So in other words, this was not a variable issue where until the late 13th century, everybody was makil and then suddenly they're machmir. This is an ongoing kind of an issue. So any claim that they changed their minds, not that you can't change your mind, but it's just not true because you've got a retzif of Tosafist texts. Again, Orbach says Tosafist Rebbe Chanan was composed in 1182 before his death, right? Great, I accept. So between 1182 and 1282, you've got a whole rock solid shitot hatos, you know, shitot balei hatosfot. So people again in learning can get all excited. Well, but from here, or in scholarship, lo dubi v'lo yar, it's completely incorrect because you have no idea of the forensics. So I'm not suggesting that people become forensic tosfot accountants. I will give one a very practical etza. Urbach's chapter 13 in Balei HaTosfot, called HaTosfot Shelanu, nothing to do with Mayim Shelanu, right? Our printed Tosfot, he goes through Masechta after Masechta by forensics, you know, proving who they quote, what are the layers. It's worth a read. It's like 2 pages per Masechta. I think it takes about 60 pages to do the whole thing, you know, 30, it's maybe 70. You at least get an idea, and that will prevent you from barking up a wrong Tosfot tree. You know, Now I'll tell you that on Brachot, Orbach has this big Ein Fallen that, again, Yeshiva Bachram know too, because people, you know enough about this. Tosot Brachot is Tosot Reuter Sirleon, good, but it was written by an Ashkenazi, says Orbach, because on Yod Aleph and Beis in Birkas HaTorah, he refers to the Hanagot of the Tzarfatim regarding Birkas HaTorah in the morning. And therefore, he invents a German student, doesn't say who he is, doesn't prove it, who was a student of Reb Moshe Mievro, who's the last Tosafist mentioned, and maybe mentioned in that Tosafist, the latest Tosafist mentioned. He was his student, but not his close student. He invents a German, right? I think the whole thing is incorrect, and it's not my Chiddush. Yudnu Nepstein, 1939, was never published until 1980-something, decided Tosafot Brachot or Rabbeinu Peretz. If Tosafot Brachot or Rabbeinu Peretz, he's Reb Moshe Mievro's student, Rabbeinu Peretz, who's French, nonetheless writes on Maharam's Tashbetz. He refers to Tzorfatim Ashkenazim. He's an equal opportunity geographic citer. Make a long story short, if it's Rabbeinu Peretz, the whole kasha goes away. There's no German Bacher Azetz. So again, it's not going to affect Lomdis, but the whole thing goes, I'm writing it now. It's fine. But, and again, Professor Orbach is there to scream at me. So, you know, it's the old story. I hope when I meet these people, they will think that I haven't lost my mind. And you are pretty good. You know, like the Ram Reb Chaim joke, not bad, but you got a couple of things wrong. I hope it'll be like that. You know, and I won't have the Ram's response because only he can make his response to that joke. But in any case, this will help learning if you know who's who. It just, there's a Rabbeinu Tam mentioned there about Birkas HaTorah. If you wake up in the middle of the night, it's a little Rabbeinu Tam, it's a Reish Mem, it's Reb Moshe Mievro. In other words, if you want to fake a name, right, you don't know who this Reb Moshe is, I don't mean fake. Sometimes he gets called Rabbeinu Chananel, Reish Chet, Yoter Mistaber. Sometimes Rabbeinu Tam, Reish Taf. So again, these are not academic points that would dissuade any serious yeshiva bacher. This is not like saying, again, ziyuf, but you have to look. The Sefer Mordechai, I'll prove it. That's the other thing that helps me a lot. The Sefer Mordechai has lots of names, dates, and serial numbers. And again, it's a good check. We tend not to use it because the printed edition is weak. But, you know, the old edition, the yeshivish edition, I don't work for Machon Yerushalayim, but their edition is very helpful. So I told that to the Kol and our yeshiva once. They said, hey, that's a good idea. So again, to the extent that you can inform yourself without completely schlepping yourself into it, you don't have to schlep yourself into it completely. You know, crazy people like me can try to schlep it, but you don't have to. Leave it to the crazy people like me, but unless you're interested. Look, I have Yeshiva Bachrim and Benot Yeshiva, who are my best doctoral students, because they've been learning all these things for years. But again, to you, Asanda Lamdin, who's not interested necessarily in the academic side, ain't no chayav liot. That's fine.
Okay. This has been absolutely fascinating. We always say it's, you know, just the tip of the iceberg here, but time is up. And
I hope I haven't gone too long or too.
Not at all.
Prosaically. I just gave a Zoom in Oxford, England, and I said something about Tsehamaz. I said, you know, tip of the iceberg, Tsehamazle. You'll have to tell me what the British idiom for that is. British have great idioms. They didn't really have one. I don't know. I thought he's something of the something. We'll have to ask other people what their idioms are. But anyway, thank you very much. And bottom line, Rambam is very interesting. So is Tosot. Gam Tosot. It's all right. Good.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Kol Tov.